To what degree is it important to me that I be a truth teller? To what degree is it important to me that I be one who affects and defends justice? Those things grow in me as I become a child of God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, in the last many weeks when we've been doing our series on what is biblical Christianity and what are the key biblical concepts, something that I keep coming back to over and over again is, well, what does that look like, Jack, in our lives? And I think that's what people really want to know. What does justification look like in my life? What does sanctification look like in my life? How do I work out my Christian faith? So we've arrived at it today, and we're going to start a series, which I think will take quite a long time, on what you've called aspects of sanctification and what holiness looks like. Jack, we can't go with that. It's too big of a mouthful. So what I've kind of renamed it is, so what's it look like to be a Christian?
Sounds good.
That sounds good?
Uh-huh.
Okay, but I know you're going to be using terms like sanctification again and holiness today. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So just for all our listening audience,
old time's sake.
Yeah. Actually, for me, since I forget things as soon as you say them, you know, sometimes I listen to our radio program, The Tapes, and I'll think, huh, did we say that? How come I don't remember that?
I used to know that.
Yeah, I used to know that. And so this is, here we've come to this, I used to know that thing again. And let's go back to what is sanctification, just real briefly.
Okay. Yeah, if you'll remember, the Greek word for holy and the Greek word for sanctify are the same root. And that's what's really confusing for us in English, is because since the etymology of holiness and sanctification are from different languages, we're clueless that those are connected with one another. But they are. They're intimately connected with one another.
And do they even sound connected? Is the spelling the same?
In the Greek, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Hagios is holy, and hagiosune is sanctification or sanctifiedness.
So they're very similar.
Yes, right. I mean, they're basically just different forms of the same word.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to keep that in mind. The reason we're called saints, which is hagiori, that is more than one hagios, we are holy ones, that's what saints means in Greek, is because we have been holified or sanctified by the Spirit of God in a process whereby God marks us as holy. And basically all it means for a human being to be holy is that they have been picked out by God for a particular divine purpose, a unique and distinctive purpose in God's plan. And the plan that is in view here is the fact that I have been picked out to be destined to be a citizen of the kingdom of God, the everlasting kingdom of God, as opposed to eternal destruction. But that's not an invisible reality. The fact that I have been chosen for that destiny, God enters into a process of making it evident that I'm one of those distinctive people by giving me a distinctive character, a distinctive heart, a distinctive by making me march to the beat of a different drum in this lifetime. And that's what we want to talk about, is what makes me distinctive looking in this life. How is it that I look so different, think so differently, perceive so differently, choose so differently in this lifetime? What's the difference?
So what are the things about a Christian, those who have been sanctified or set apart by God, that makes them, that shows up that they're a Christian?
Right. Yeah, you could put it that way. You probably have noticed that I try really hard to avoid using the language Christian.
Because, I have noticed that.
Yeah, because what's confusing about that is that really all it takes to be a Christian is to kind of line up with the Christian story, the biblical, or some version of it. And what the Bible is getting at is more, it's really more penetrating than that. And that is, there are going to be a lot of Christians who are not really children of God, who are not saints in the sense that the Bible talks about saints or holy ones. They have not been set apart for this new destiny. They, in this world, for one of many different motives, they've lined up with the Christian faith and the Christian cause, but they have not been marked by the Spirit of God as distinctive people.
So you are making a real distinction, not only between people who live in the United States and therefore they would consider themselves a Christian as opposed to perhaps a Muslim.
Right.
Generally speaking, there are more Christians in the United States in that sense than there are people of other religions, generally speaking.
Right.
You're making that distinction also between perhaps people who often perhaps go to church and would consider themselves Christians because they arrived at church many Sundays of their lives and did kind of adhere to the Judeo-Christian lifestyle that we have here in the United States or somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in a conservative, Bible-believing, evangelical culture. I mean, I was born and raised in it. I was immersed in that culture. We were serious about our faith. We were convinced that we took the faith seriously in a way that other Christian traditions did not take the faith seriously. We practiced our faith. We sought to obey God. We sought to believe the truth. We sought to understand the truth. I mean, you couldn't fault us for our Christianity. I mean, I think our Christianity was about as intense as you could possibly get and about as serious-minded and sober-minded as you could possibly get. And yet, what I think the Bible is saying is what we took to be the hallmarks of being a Christian were not what the New Testament lays out as the hallmarks of being a Christian. Whereas we would look at things like, how often do you study your Bible? How often do you pray? How pious is your language and how pious is your lifestyle? What is your walk with God like? And we could define that. But
are you worshiping? Are you fellowshipping?
Yes.
Are you keeping a prayer list? Are you praying daily? Are you having a quiet time? Those kinds of things you are very serious about.
Right. And if those were the hallmarks of the saint, then we were saints. But what the New Testament does is give us an entirely different portrait of what it means to be a child of God, singled out by God for this special destiny. And it's none of those things. None of those things count. What counts is something else, and that's what this is all about.
None of those things count. They could be an outcropping of what we're going to be talking about.
Right, right. That's true.
And they could be very good things that come out of a different kind of heart. But I think what you're going to be getting at today is God's looking at our heart and not our outward actions.
Right.
And that's what I would say also I did in my life. I had a lot of outward actions, but my heart had not been convinced, had not been given life by the Spirit of God.
Yes, yeah.
And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, let me give an example. Let's take something like Bible study. Outwardly, one person studying the Bible is doing the same thing as another person studying the Bible. They're studying the Bible. But studying the Bible can be grounded in very, very different things. One person may have a real hunger and thirst for the truth and really be on it from their heart, from deep down inside, be on a quest to understand God's revelation, the truth of who God is and what he's up to in the world. And that's what's motivating it. That's the ground out of which that action is flowing. Another person has simply become convinced that good Christians study the Bible. So they study the Bible, but when they come to passages that are teaching them truths that are inconvenient or uncomfortable or not particularly interesting to them, they don't really want to, that truth to be true, they can distort the meaning of the text, misinterpret it, somehow deflect.
Set it aside.
Set it aside, just ignore it, yeah. But by some kind of strategy, not really ever confront the truth in the Bible. Well, which is the child of God? The first one is the child of God. The second one is a Christian. They're religious. They're in their own project in life. They're really serious about it. But the New Testament would not recognize them as a true child of God if they can continue in that avoidance of truth, in their strategy to avoid the truth, then they can't be a child of God. We'll talk about that as one of the aspects of sanctification. But that's what I'm getting at, is that we picked outward symptoms and said that those in and of themselves, like prayer, Bible study, worship, and so on, that those in and of themselves are the hallmark of what it means to be a Christian. The New Testament is looking deeper and saying, maybe, but we need to dig deeper and find out what it's rooted in. If it's not rooted in the right thing, then those things are meaningless.
Now, Jack, as you're talking, what I'm thinking is, there may be a lot of people who are listening today who just think what you said was horrible, not true. How could you possibly say such a thing? I'm sure that you recognize that there's a lot of people that would disagree with you. What do you do with that kind of situation where you have a very strong commitment to what you're saying, and yet you also recognize that there's a lot of people who do not also agree with you?
What do I do with it?
Yeah.
How do I handle that with a person, you mean?
Inside yourself.
Oh, okay.
It has been said, for example, that you're very strong in your beliefs, and it kind of leaves a lot of people, other people and their beliefs out. So I wonder how you deal with that.
Well, a couple of things. It didn't used to be the case that people who were strong in their beliefs were somehow looked on with suspicion. For most of the history of the church, most of the Bible teachers, the preachers, the theologians, the Christian philosophers have felt very strongly about their beliefs and have defended them pretty vigorously. And I want to talk about why and on what basis they would do that. It's a relatively modern phenomenon that we need to make room for everybody. It's a symptom of the kind of relativism, the softness toward disagreement that we see even in a Bible-believing church today, I think is a reflection of our larger culture, secular culture. If you look at the secular culture, what the secular culture is saying is diversity is the prime virtue. Everybody should do their own thing, believe their own thing, practice their own thing, and our job is to leave them alone and let them go. And the worst thing that we could ever do, the most evil thing in the world, is to ever point a finger at somebody and say, I think you're wrong. I mean, that wrong is a four-letter word in secular culture today. That attitude kind of leaks into the Christian culture as well. And so we kind of have this attitude that it's unloving to say to someone you're wrong. Well, I just don't believe that. I mean, I would hope that people would, if they know that I'm misinterpreting the Bible and I'm misinterpreting and misunderstanding my faith, the loving thing I think for them to do is say, Jack, you're wrong. Let me show you how. Let me show you why. Take me to the Bible, take me to Scripture, take me to arguments, take me to reasons, and demonstrate to me that I really need to see this thing differently because I'm misperceiving it. I would argue that's the loving thing to do, not the unloving thing to do. Where does the strength come from? The strength comes from the confidence that you have gone to the Scriptures, to the Bible, and you have, with some conscientiousness and some responsibility, sought to understand what it's saying, and lived with it and stayed with it and worked with it long enough to think you've come to some sound conclusions. Now, just because I think I've come to some sound conclusions doesn't make it so. I mean, I may be wrong. But I don't think I'm wrong, and it's out of that confidence that I have understood what the Scripture is saying that I feel the confidence to speak. So the confidence is not my own. I mean, I'm not saying, aren't I clever? I've come up with a way of looking at the world that I like, and I've created it. I'm just a student. I mean, I'm just learning. Many, many people have been there long before I have. In fact, I feel kind of slow. I mean, I'm constantly recognizing, I come to a conclusion and I go, oh yeah, that's what Augustine was saying, and that's what Aquinas was saying, and that's what that youth pastor who was teaching me in my youth was saying, and it's taken me 40 years to figure it out. I feel pretty slow all the time, like I'm just always playing catch up. But my confidence comes from the fact that the Bible has taught me, and it's a very reliable teacher.
And I think it would be true to say that there are many other Bible teachers who have been good students of the Bible who come up with different conclusions. In that kind of situation, how do we deal with it, Jack? There's people that may be hearing us and hearing perhaps their pastor at church. They respect you as a student. They respect their pastor as a student. But your conclusions are different. Mm-hmm. Where do they go with that?
They need to take to heart what Jesus said. Let no man call you teacher. There's only one teacher. That ultimately God has to be our teacher. And the way God has chosen to speak to us is through the scriptures. So as I'm listening to different Bible teachers, I need to allow my own study of the Bible, my own perception of what the Bible is saying, to ultimately stand in judgment over what those teachers are saying. Practically, the way to do that for most people and with the busy lives that they lead is they're going to have to insist that their Bible teacher explain his reasoning to them or her reasoning to them. You say the Bible is teaching this. You say this passage means X. Tell me how you got there. Explain your reasoning. Explain your rationale for coming to that conclusion rather than some other conclusion. Because everybody is intelligent. Everybody can assess for themselves the soundness of an argument, the strength of an argument, how convincing, how compelling is it really. They can't do the scholarly work of looking at the Greek and studying the Greek language and familiarizing themselves with the syntax and looking at background, geography, history, that kind of stuff. Not everyone has the time to do that. But what they can do is just use their common sense to judge how strong a conclusion really is based on the evidence. But in order to do that, they have to have someone lay out the evidence and the reasoning for them. There's two problems they're going to run into when they insist on that, though. One is they're going to meet the sinfulness of us who are Bible teachers, of us who are Bible teachers. They're going to find us defensive. I don't want to lay out my evidence because maybe you'll find that my argument is weaker than it actually is. And so it's going to take a great deal of courage, a great deal of integrity, a great deal of transparency on my part to be willing to do that. So that's one problem, is you may find me hiding. The second problem is all of us are operating it to some degree intuitively. That is, I have my reasons, but I'm not sure I can always dredge them up and articulate them for you. And so we have to give the Bible teacher some room. I mean, allow him to be intuitive. But that's where you just need to work harder to judge his intuitions. You know, how good do you think his intuitions are here? Now, I'm not saying that over the course of time, a Bible teacher cannot prove himself or demonstrate himself to you to be relatively trustworthy. I mean, that's just human life, is that we grow to trust people in what they do. So I think Bible teachers can sort of over time demonstrate themselves to be trustworthy. But even when that's the case, if what they're saying is controversial or comes into conflict with what someone else that I trust is saying, then I need to sit back and say, but is he making a mistake this time? And I need to decide that. Ultimately, we all individually need to take responsibility for the belief system that we hold. I can't just hand my mind over to some Bible teacher and say, here, think for me. You tell me what to think and I'll just think it. I think that's something that a true child of God cannot continue to do. He cannot ultimately stay there, because part of what it means to be a child of God, I think, is the kind of integrity, the kind of courage, the kind of righteousness that will take ownership for their own view of reality. Did I answer your question? I'm sorry, I kind of got off there.
I think it's a little bit of a soapbox,
yeah,
isn't it?
He didn't ask for
I didn't really know I was going to get all that. I definitely think that you answered my question. And just for everybody to get back to what the question was, is you were saying something that I think a lot of people may disagree with. I think there's many times when we say things on this program where you are putting forth a belief system that may be different than some other pretty mainstream churches of our day, and I wanted to know how you dealt with that, mm-hmm. and what you thought about that. So it's kind of a underlying issue that comes up for me a lot as we're talking and thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I particularly liked about what you said was that you think that it's a good thing that people would be willing to come to you and say, I'm not sure you're right. I think you may be wrong. That's a loving thing. And for you to say that makes me think you'd be willing to hear people when they ask you those kinds of questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's a place where you have to be very humble to be able to accept that kind of a situation, or at least it certainly is a process through which you're humbled when you have to sit back and ask yourself the question, have I been wrong here?
Yeah, I really do welcome it. It has aided me tremendously in my coming to understand the faith. In my classes, when I'll teach the Bible, every now and then somebody will raise a question and they'll go, well, what about this? And I'll stumble my way through some kind of answer at the time. I mean, sometimes I see it right away and say, you know what, that's really a problem. But that's rare. I mean, usually I
cover
myself and give some kind of dance around the issue somehow and give some kind of stupid answer. And then I go away and I think about it.
Where the person is maybe left confused but thinks.
Yeah, totally confused.
But thinks, well, I guess Jack did understand it. I'm just not very smart,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, which is a terrible thing to do.
It is.
But
shame on you.
But in fairness to me, too, I just don't think that fast. You know, I'm not sure that I can see whether or not it really is a challenge I need to deal with or not until I have time to go away and mull it over. And
then you think, my heavens, I just confused myself,
yeah,
and the other person, and
yeah,
I better really think through this.
But I have had some significant alterations in my view of what a book is saying or something result from a question or a challenge that somebody has made in a class. Because I take them very seriously. I have to take them seriously. If I don't have an answer for them, then I don't have any business believing what I'm believing and teaching what I'm teaching, if I can't answer that objection. So it's a very important part of the process, I think, for a teacher to be confronted by things that other people are seeing that I just haven't seen. You know, it's not that I'm deliberately trying to go the wrong direction. For whatever reasons, the way my mind has gone, that objection never occurred to me. And it's a serious objection.
Okay.
So it's very, very helpful. The thing that's tragic, though, are the people that respond by saying, Jack, you can't be right. I've never heard that before. That makes me sad, because it's not that can't be right because here's an objection. That can't be right because look at the next verse. That can't be right because look at the passage this way. Doesn't that make more sense? That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is, that can't be right because it's unfamiliar to me, and I'm not willing to believe anything that I'm not already familiar with. That just makes me sad.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Okay, I appreciate this little detour we've been down. Let's go back then to what is holiness.
What I'm going to do, and I'm not, this is more just for the purposes of kind of organizing my thoughts than it is any profound point, I think. But in Romans chapter 1, when Paul is describing our rebellion against God and our inherently evil nature, he divides up our evil into two categories. He talks about God giving us over to degrading passions, and then says a little bit about that. And then he turns and talks about God giving us over to a depraved mind. Actually, depraved is not in the text. It's sort of, it's hard to translate. It's sort of, he gave us over to a mind that's kind of a poor excuse for a mind, I think is the idea. A mind that really
quite a paraphrase.
Doesn't look like a mind.
A mind that's gone haywire.
Yeah, a broken mind. So I'm going to organize my thoughts around those two categories. That when God comes along, he sanctifies my mind, and he sanctifies my passions. He touches me and begins to repair me in those two areas. Now, having said that, I don't want to be misunderstood here. My sanctification is not fixing what's wrong with me. It's important to see that. And we've already talked about that, but I'm coming at it from a different direction. So let me repeat myself. It's not that...
you can always repeat yourself again. I don't remember from day to day, so we have to go over and over and over these concepts.
Okay.
It's not
that God comes and, for the believer, he makes it so they no longer have a broken mind. That's not the case. My mind will remain... My understanding is going to remain fundamentally foolish to the end of my time here on earth. I'm basically a fool, and I remain a fool. But I'm a fool, although I'm a fool at the profoundest and deepest level of my being and understanding, yet I'm being trained in, by the Spirit of God, I'm being trained in truths about reality that give me some insight into who God is, what I am, what I ought to be, what reality is all about, so that at a surface level, at a more superficial level, and yet by superficial I don't mean that it's not substantial. He's given me a substantial understanding of reality that's true and right and good. That's
and so, in what way am I a fool if I am getting this understanding of reality, which sounds like wisdom to me.
Right, yeah, that's a good word for it.
So how am I a fool?
Well, because I don't always act out of the wisdom that I am acquiring.
So I may know, for example, that I need to be kind to somebody. You know, I just wrote about this in the letter that we're sending out to our audience, but this is... I think I have an example of being a fool, so I'm going to use it right now. Our oven broke, and we've only had it for about a year. But we bought our house about a year ago, and the stove was new. Even the paper hadn't been taken out of it, but the house wasn't completely new, so obviously the guy didn't cook. Anyway, the stove got broken, and I have always hated the stove. It's got some really bad design problems. So I called the customer service, and I started talking to them about that, and I wanted them to do some replacement of some things. And they just basically said, thank you for letting us know about this, but we're not going to do anything about it because it's an older version. Even though it's new to you, basically, after a year, it went out of style. We're not doing that anymore, so... sorry, we're not going to do anything for you. Well, I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And let me tell you, I was awful. I was terrible to this lady. It was appalling, some of the things that came out of my mouth. I have felt terrible about it for the last 3 or 4 days. She ended up, in fact, hanging up on me because I was so awful. It was terrible. Ah, I hate thinking about it. But I think I know how to treat people well. Mm-hmm. I know how to be kind. But there I was in the midst of a situation where I wasn't getting what I wanted, and I lost it. Mm-hmm. I was a fool.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's precisely it, yeah. Another example, the thing I was talking about earlier, I can sit here and tell you how I, as a Bible teacher, ought to respond to someone challenging my teaching. But get me in a particular situation, and I am just as likely to be defensive, intimidating, obnoxious.
You know, Jack, there are times when I've experienced you that way.
Yeah.
And I know you to be a person that really wants to be kind, that wants to consider what people say, just like what you just told us a few minutes ago. But there have been times when I've experienced you as being really hard and really tough. In fact, you kind of look like my dad. Don't cross me, Christine. You know? So I think we're both copying to, as much as we would like to live according to the wisdom that God's been has given us in terms of our understanding of what life, of reality, of how we should be, how we should treat other people, who God is, we simply do not.
Right.
A lot of the time.
Right. So that's what I meant. At the deepest level, we're fools. Because if at the deepest level we were not fools, then treating people with love and respect and kindness and compassion and justice would be as natural to us as breathing. I mean, it would just spontaneously flow out of us because it's the right thing to do. But our experience is exactly the opposite. I really need to work. I need to stop myself and say, "No, Jack, that wouldn't be right, so don't go there." Why do I have to stop myself and tell myself what way to go? Why don't I go that way naturally? Because I'm a fool. Because I'm evil. Because I have a depraved mind that is fundamentally self-centered, that sees myself as the center of the universe, and I'm entitled for everybody to give me what I want. I mean, that's my basic fundamental vision of life, if I don't think about it. But if I think about it, I've been trained by the Spirit of God to recognize that that's not true and to know another truth. My commitment to living according to the truth, if I'm really a child of God, is substantial.
Right.
I mean, I really am committed to it, and I really do want my life to be lived in the light of that, but sometimes I don't have time to even think about it, and the real me just kind of leaks
shows
out.
Up.
Yeah.
Shows up big time. Yeah. So what you're really saying is that we have not been repaired at the core of our soul.
Right.
And that's the sense in which we are fools. What God is doing is repairing our understanding of what is right and good. Out of this unrepaired heart, we'll sometimes just have these knee-jerk reactions like I did with the customer service representative over the phone.
Yeah, can I stop you for a second, though? I want to reserve the word heart for the part that is being repaired rather than the part that's not being repaired.
Okay.
Because I think that's the way the New Testament describes it.
Okay, so there's this part of us in the core of our beings that's not repaired, out of which we act in a very sinful, selfish, self-serving way.
Right.
There's another part of us, I think you're going to be calling our heart, that is being repaired in terms of understanding the truth about God, about ourselves, about other people. We're understanding reality. We're getting wise. When we have time to think about situations, if we're very committed to the truth, even in difficult situations, believers will probably go in the direction of what is good. I'm thinking about a different situation for myself. A relative sent me a letter, and it was actually very... It was a very uncomfortable letter for me, and what I wanted to do was, my knee-jerk reaction, and good thing I wasn't talking to this person in person, was to just nail them on what they said, because on one hand, I think what they said is really ridiculous and really hurtful to me, and not reality at all. And so in my head, out of this core part of me that's foolish, I've come up with all these different awful reactions to them. And I want to write them down and just send off a letter. But this other part of me says, no. Don't protect yourself in that way. Don't defend yourself in that way. Don't be mean. In whatever way that you respond to this person, try as hard as you can to do what's right. Now, I might not come up with what's right. I may have this foolish part kind of mixed in.
Right, right.
But I know that it's right for me to try. As much as my selfishness would just like to beat them up.
Yeah, that's good.
There's another part. It's not good that I want to. What's good, Jack?
Yeah, that's a good analysis of. I mean, just because we try doesn't mean we succeed. I mean, I think that's a very important point to make.
It's a really important point, I think, because so many times I don't succeed, and right. yet I'm really trying. So, what I'm doing in this situation is trying to be wise, trying to take time, trying to think about it, knowing that I still may goof it up. But a point that I often make in my counseling to people is, it isn't if you do it all right, but if you have the desire to try to do it right, if you're working toward that. And of course you're going to make tons of mistakes, but the heart, the desire to pursue what's good is what is really valuable, and certainly what God values.
Right. And we are not saying, because I suppose somebody could interpret your words this way, that as long as you're sincere, it's okay.
No,
that's not what we're saying.
That's not what I'm saying.
Rather, what we're saying is as long as it's authentic, it's okay. That is, there's a huge difference between authenticity and sincerity. A lot of people are sincere in their foolishness, in their commitment to foolishness. But we're talking about an authentic commitment to what is right and good. And that's different.
Yes.
In her News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies, Mackenzie Study Center staff member Nancy Scott examines the common Christian belief that spiritual maturity depends on pursuing a personal relationship or friendship with God. She argues that the test of one's relationship with God is not whether one feels in fellowship with God. Rather, it is how one answers the question, what are we going to do with the fact that God is in charge of our lives and we are not? She states, the choices we make about how we respond to the circumstances of our lives, and not whether we pursue friendship with God, will ultimately attest to God's working in our lives. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies.
What does the Christian life look like? What does holiness look like? Well, it looks like God, in a general sense, like God is making some fundamental changes in my mind and in my passions.
Right.
Okay, I think we've got our mind, but what do you mean our passions? How is God making some fundamental changes in my passions? What are my passions?
Well, if my mind is the way I understand the world, my passions reflect what I want, what I desire, what's interesting to me, what am I motivated toward, what do I love? And that word is intending to capture that. It's the non-intellectual part of me. It's not about how I'm putting my understanding of the world together. It's how I'm being driven by the things that I like and love and am attracted to.
So what God is doing is changing my responses to
mm-hmm.
situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about with passions. We just recently finished a series on sexuality, and one of the things we talked about there was pornography. What I argued back then is that not every sexual practice between consenting adults is necessarily righteous. Why? Because as sinful human beings, we don't necessarily like things that ought to be liked. You know, sometimes we desire things that shouldn't even be desirable to us. I think pornography in all of its forms is one of those things. In my sinfulness, it can get a hook in me, and I can have a craving for the kind of adrenaline rush and arousal that comes from thinking thoughts and seeing images. But should I want that rush? Should I want that high? Should I want that for myself? No, I shouldn't. It's not appropriate. It's not right. It's not good. My desire for purity, my desire for righteousness, my desire for goodness ought to override any desire that or any attraction I have to that. And part of my sanctification is God coming and putting into the forefront the desire for things that ought to be desired and shoving way into the background, ultimately, hopefully, to non-existence. In eternity, things that ought not to be wanted, ought not to be desired.
I'm thinking, using your example, thinking of a particular person that I work with in counseling who has been very much addicted to pornography for a very long time. This person came to counseling ready to expose that and wanting it not to be a part of their life. They've really struggled with getting rid of it, they've failed a tremendous amount. But this is what you're talking about. They're not wanting it anymore.
Right.
And they're trying to commit themselves to not having it be a part of their life. Now, they may die with pornography being a big problem still in their life. I think certainly for this person, less of a problem. But it's, I think, probably going to be a problem for a long, long time.
Yeah.
If not forever, because it has such inroads in this person's life.
And contrast that with the unsanctified, unredeemed people that we know and see around us, who instead of being bothered by that, actually literally glory in their indulging in pornography.
Quite a contrast.
They pride themselves in it in some sense. They kind of get in your face and shamelessly flaunt the fact that's a part of their life. That's an entirely different attitude. They're driven by entirely different passions. Let me give you another example of what I mean by a passion. One of the things that we'll talk about is that the child of God has a growing love of the truth. We know a lot of people who are around us who are really quite willing to be very cavalier about truth. They'll tell the truth normally, just because why not? But if it ever becomes convenient to not tell the truth, they're quite willing to go there. They're quite willing to twist things, misrepresent things, out and out contradict what's real and what's right. I mean, what's accurate. Other people just they have such a love, or let me call it a passion, for truth telling that it is very, very difficult for them to live with the fact that they have misrepresented something. They may do it out of their innate foolishness, but it bothers them. Why does it bother them? Because they really do want very deeply to be a truth teller. That's what I'm getting at by the way God comes and begins to change our passions. To what degree is it important to me that I be a truth teller? To what degree is it important to me that I be one who affects and defends justice? Those things grow in me as I become a child of God.
And it isn't only, those are not just important to me, like telling the truth isn't just important to me when I get caught.
Right, right.
And I think that's really a good telltale sign of, is this a true, truly important thing for me? Is it just because I got caught, or is it because before I got caught, or maybe I'll never get caught, that it's still nonetheless very important to
me?
Yeah,
that's a good point, exactly.
And I'm thinking about this conversation again that I had on the phone. I'm a little bit obsessed by it, but it isn't that I feel bad because I'm ever going to, I mean, I think this person probably lives in the East Coast or something that I was talking to. And it's not that they're going to be in my life on a daily basis, and so I have to just, you know, fess up to it because it's there, because they're right in my face. It's, I just don't like it. I don't like that I was that way. I hate it. And I will probably never hear from this person again in my life, but it was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I feel bad about it. I don't want to be that way. Yuck.
Yeah.
Okay, Jack, so what's up next?
Okay, so we don't have time to develop any of these, but just to give a roadmap of where we're headed, our holiness consists of not only a sanctification of what I'm calling my mind or my heart, but also my passions. But we'll look at several subtopics under each of those. In the sanctification of my mind, we're going to see that the child of God will have a growing understanding of God. They will have a growing understanding of this creation that God has made. We'll have a growing understanding of ourselves, and we'll have a growing understanding of others. It's this growing understanding in all those areas that is the wisdom that God gives us in our sanctification.
So the change that God gives us is a growing understanding of these three areas.
Right. Actually, I think it was four, but those four areas.
Hey, yeah. Who's counting? So that's what we have to look forward to in part in the future.
Uh-huh.
What else do we have to look forward to?
And then with respect to our passions, we have a growing love of righteousness, a growing love of God, and a diminishing love of the world. Those three things, I think. And we'll develop all three of those topics.
I'm sure we will. This sounds like we're going to be talking about this a really long time.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. So let's look at what we've talked about today. Could you do that for us real briefly? What are the things, Jack, that you think you would like people to take away with them today? Well, I'm going to steal it from you. Because what I'm thinking, you're thinking too long. My turn. Am I stopping you?
No, go ahead.
Okay. What I'm taking away is that holiness is not how I always thought when I first became a Christian. It wasn't that I am going to be this perfect person. I thought that God was going to make me kind of this really, really squeaky clean type of person. And that's not what sanctification is about. That's not what the Christian life is about. That the Christian life is about that in eternity. But it's not like that here. Because at the core of my being, what you're saying is, I remain foolish in that I remain a person who is broken, I'm like a broken down car. And it's always going to be, I don't think that's a good example. I'm not like a broken down car, but my mind is not going to ever be fully repaired. So I act in a really squeaky clean, holy way. But what is being changed by God is my mind, and that I have a greater understanding of who He is, who I am, who other people are, an understanding of how to relate to these people and to God. And God is changing my passions such that I want different things.
Right.
And it isn't that I have to have it all put together, but I can depend on God and His mercy to be bringing me along in this course.
And we didn't say that today, but I think it's important to say to put in the context, what we said today in the context of something we've said in the past. That we have to understand that sanctification is something that God is doing. I mean, just the life of the believer is ultimately the believer watching himself be transformed over the course of time as God begins to give us different desires, different perceptions, different way of looking at reality that just begin to emerge in us seemingly mysteriously as the Spirit of God just grows me up into mature sanctification.
Well, today we didn't say that God does that, and we sure should have.
Yeah.
That's a really huge point. Thank you.
Over the years, the teachers of McKenzie Study Center have offered many classes, from studies in the book of Romans and Revelation, to a biblical view of history and culture, to sexuality and relationships. McKenzie has also presented conferences ranging on topics such as education, evolution, and the arts. Most of the lectures and discussions are available on tape and can be purchased for a modest fee. McKenzie also has a tape catalog to help you make your choosing easier. To order tapes or get a copy of the catalog, Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Our board of directors has given us the task of requesting financial support from people at the end of each of our programs. And Jack, for you and I, this is a very awkward and difficult request that they've made of us. And yet we both feel like it's something we really need to try to strive toward. Because the reality is, if we don't have financial support, over time we won't be able to continue this program.
I hope people can understand the position that you and I are coming from. We could be saying, look, I'm going to jump off this cliff, you better catch me. That is, I'm in great peril, and somebody's going to have to save me. So won't you save me?
Why don't you get out your checkbook and write the check right now?
Yeah, exactly. That's not my position. I know that's not your position. We are really quite willing to not have this radio program funded, and if it goes off the air, it goes off the air. I mean, it's not my call. It's not my position to know what ought to happen in this world. That's God's job. And he may very well pull the plug on this program, and I understand that, and I accept that, and I think that's just fine, if God so wills.
Can I interject something
right
at this point? I haven't been at that point from the beginning of the program. At the very beginning, I wanted it so badly to continue. And it's taken me quite a period of time to come to that conclusion in my own life and really be able to embrace it. That I would really like to continue the program. I have to say that, and I think it's very valuable, and I've heard great feedback from a lot of people, both from letters and from people here locally. So I'd like to continue it, Jack, and I like doing it. I like what I learn from you personally. But I've also come to the conclusion that this is God's program. This is God's life, and he gets to be the one that chooses whether we continue or we don't.
Right. Yeah.
But it's not been an easy struggle for me. I want this.
Yeah, sure. There's the evil, selfish ambition that crops up in all of us at times with respect to so many things in our lives. And we can't even always sort out what our motives are. But I think what I can say with confidence is we both know what our motives ought to be, you know, what perspective we should be able to take toward this program. And so it's in that spirit that we want to just lay out the facts that we had some original funding that financed us for a whole year and into a second year. We don't know how far it'll stretch. But if we are going to continue, there's going to have to be more funding, and we don't know who else to go to other than the listeners. We're not saying, I'm jumping, you better catch me. We don't know what the future's going to hold. But if you find that the sort of thing that we've been doing is valuable for yourself, and you believe that it's valuable enough for other people, that it's worth investing in, then we would certainly welcome your support. That's what we're saying.
That's what we're saying. Well said, Jack.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.